You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Hey, Power Athlete Nation, we have a cool one for you today with Dr. Craig Heller from CoolMet. So I was a little skeptical when I got reached out to by CoolMet. They sent us some devices, which actually are like look like a cylinder. Like imagine a large kind of thermos looking device with some hoses, and they fit into your hands to cool your palms. So they sent me a bunch of the research and I went through it, but didn't do a super deep dive. And we've been just kind of using them intermittently within the gym. Booked the podcast with PhD Stanford professor, Dr. Craig Heller, who's still a teaching professor, PhD in biology from Yale, and has a interest in the roles of sleep and circadian rhythms and learning and memory, and more importantly, temperature regulation for humans as it relates to not only performance, but every other facet from heart health, hypertrophy and whatnot. So they've developed these CoolMet technology over a number of years. And I am completely floored with not only this podcast, the information and what he was talking about for using it for hypertrophy studies and volume for push-ups and pull-ups and some of the anecdotal stuff. So we dig in on the elements of the CoolMets, more importantly, how to cool the hands, how it works, what the temperature and the performance enhancing effects, which he was able to, you know, claim and substantiate through research, are very performance enhancing steroid-esque. So it also relates not only to hypertrophy and strength, but also to endurance. So after having this conversation, I have a whole host of notes that I'm going to go through and figure out how I can start dropping this into my own training and the guys that I'm working with in terms of managing lactate, looking to improve strength, and hopefully increase performance. So I am pretty excited. So tune in for not only an amazing guest, but a really good dude. Dr. Craig Heller. Pretty interesting technology. We had the opportunity to get the guys ended up sending us out the CoolMets, and you know, we've been playing with them and using them. I trained some professional Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu guys, and you know, trying to use them in between rounds and go through. So I thought it'd be great to have an interesting conversation and see how we can progress this, and more importantly, how this whole thing kind of started and dig in on it.
Great, I love to talk about it.
Well, then I will stand back. Can you give me the macro and we'll drill down from there?
Yeah. Questions are good. So what did you say?
I was just interested to, you know, not only your background, but how you got started. Yeah. And more importantly, how you kind of developed into this technology. Sure. And what you've seen and, you know, kind of the performance KPIs that we can expect from it. And more importantly, how do we use it? And you know, what's the frequency? And, you know, the guys kept asking me, why can't we just get buckets of cold water? And I was like, well,
that's always the question.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm Craig Heller. I'm professor of biology at Stanford. I've been here a very long time. So I've been through all of the big games with your alma mater.
Go Bears.
Yeah. So I guess I like to describe my career as always being going to the next interesting thing. So I actually started out at Yale in ecology. And that's because when I got there on the first day, I was told that if you were an ecology student, you could go anywhere you wanted in the summer to do field work. So I spent every summer in the Sierra Nevada, studying animals in the Sierra Nevada. And after I left graduate school, I'd never done ecology again, but I got interested in physiology. And that took me into temperature, because the animals that I worked with during the summer were hibernating in the winter. So I was interested in how the brain controls body temperature and how it manages to put a mammal down to close to 0 degrees and bring it back again. So I've spent a lot of my career working on hibernation, including recently, we're still working on a big data set from bears that we've collected. But then interested in temperature and hibernation got me interested in sleep and circadian rhythms. So I've spent a lot of time studying the neurobiology of sleep and circadian rhythms, And as a matter of fact, which is of interest to you, is just last month, I and a bunch of other sleep and circadian biologists published a white paper, which is essentially trying to bring some sense to this reorganization of the collegiate athletic conferences, which puts Stanford and Berkeley at very, very in a very different, difficult position, and a position which does not help our students at all, either
no,
academically
or athletically. I went with the exact same thing. As soon as I saw that whole thing, all I could imagine is all of the flights and the travel. Yeah. I mean, it looks like a logistical nightmare as a student athlete.
Yeah, one of the worst things for performance is jet lag.
Yeah.
And certainly chronic jet lag is really bad and also bad for your health. And people are using as the example, travel to Washington, that's only 4 or 5 hours. No, but these places to travel to take 2 flights. And it's more like 15 or 16 hours per flight.
And they're also flying commercially.
We're not going to go there.
Well, but and they're also flying commercially. You know, playing football, we tend to charter our own planes because it's a lot of people going. But most of the smaller teams are flying commercially.
Absolutely.
We also do, I spent much of my youth up in the Sierra Nevadas. My parents bought a place in Mammoth in the 70s. So every free weekend we were either up there fishing, hiking, or skiing. So I spent a lot of time in that similar part of the world.
Wonderful, wonderful place.
Yeah, we had all these Ansel Keys. Is that it? Ansel Keys? The photographer? Ansel Adams. And Ansel Adams.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, my dad was always a member of the Sierra Club, and we always had all these pictures around. So, you know, the minarets and the Sierra. I mean, so... Yeah.
So we have strong relationships there. I'll just finish the last chapter of the story of what I do and why I do it. Is my colleague and I once had a discussion with a friend of ours who's an anesthesiologist. And he said, "You think you know so much about temperature regulation, I bet you can't solve a problem we have in the recovery room." What's that? Patients come out of surgery hypothermic, very cold. And it takes the nurses hours to get them to stop shivering. Trivial problem. No, it's a very hard problem, because when your body temperature is low, which it is during anesthesia, and that anesthesia wears off, you constrict all of your peripheral blood vessels and send the blood into the core of your body. So if you're then trying to put heat across the body surface, it's like putting heat into a body over a fur coat. I mean, you just can't do it. So we got a crazy idea that if we put one arm in a negative pressure environment, slight vacuum, we'd pull the blood into that arm, heat the arm, and it would go back to the core of the body. And the first patient we did, it was like 9 minutes back up to normal temperature. Mm. We couldn't believe it. We later found out it was just the hand, not the arm. And then we found out from the literature that the palms of the hands, which are called non-hairy skin, have special blood vessels. And these blood vessels shunt the blood from the arteries coming from the heart to the veins going back to the heart, bypassing the capillaries, which are the nutritive vessels and are high resistance. So we then suddenly had this insight that we were dealing with a natural adaptation for heat loss. We were just using it in reverse. So then we started using it to pull heat out bodies. And we had still have a research assistant who was a gym rat. He would go to the gym every night after work. And in order to do these experiments, we had to have someone hot. So we asked him to do his workouts in the lab. He'd get overheated and then we'd pull the heat out. So in order to have a strict protocol, we had him do pull-ups. And he did 10 sets of pull-ups to muscle failure with 3-minute rests. And of course you get a fatigue curve. Every set is less and less and less and less. And then we would, at the end of that 10 sets, we would pull the heat out of his body with our prototype, whatever it was we were building at the time, and measure what's the right temperature, the right vacuum, and so forth and so on. So one day, for no reason, after he did his last set of pull-ups and we cooled him, he went back to the pull-up bar and did the same number of pull-ups as in his first set. And we said, "Holy cow, what does that mean?" It means that the muscle failure is due to the rise in temperature of the muscle. If you take that heat out of the muscle keeps on working. So if you increase your work volume when you go to the gym, you condition, you get better, right? You certainly have experienced that.
Yeah, no, I've lifted a few weights in my life.
Yeah. So the next 6 weeks, we were cooling him after his every other set of pull-ups. And he went from, at the beginning of that 6 weeks, 180 pull-ups, which is already damn good, to 618.
So,
can you imagine? So 618 gnarly behind the head pull-ups.
So how many? So he was doing 618 over 10 sets?
10 sets with 3-minute cooling episodes.
Wow. And he did 618 pull-ups. It's a lot of pull-ups.
So, and of course he got bigger.
Well, we interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Do you want to build thick, sidewalk-splitting slabs of muscle? Let me introduce you to Jack Street. Get access to the same tried and true training methods I followed during my 10 years in the NFL, all to walk into training camp at 308 pounds at sub 8% body fat. Punch your ticket to the gain train and join thousands of residents already following Jack Street. Head to powerathletehq.com/Jack Street and claim your 7-day free trial today. Now back to the show.
It's kind of an interesting balance between, you know, hypertrophy. If you look at all the research, especially the stuff that's come out in the last few years, it talks about mechanical tension, mechanical failure as the drivers for hypertrophy. Yeah. So now you're finding a way to increase work capacity so you can push to new types of failure.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you about the hypertrophy. First of all, I can we have data on a lot of studies which have used performance-enhancing drugs in a strict protocol. There aren't many. It's a lot of random studies, but there are a bunch of good studies on bench press. And from those studies, they all agree that the performance-enhancing steroids will help you increase by 1%, I think it was per week, 1% per week. It may have been episode because they were usually 2 or 3 times a week with a day of rest in between. So we get many, many, many times that with whatever it's dips or bench press. We're so far beyond that. It isn't even funny.
So what you're saying is we have to couple steroids with cooling the hands. This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show.
Yeah, those studies were not cooling. Those studies in the literature were simply comparing performance conditioning with and without steroids.
Okay, so just going forward, we're going to take steroids with the hands cooling then, because we're going to get the most of both
steroids
worlds.
Steroids without.
I'm just making a joke.
Okay, yeah, do both. Yeah. You don't need to.
Yeah.
You don't need to.
Well, let
me tell you one more thing about the hypertrophy, which you'll love. And that is, I had a group of students that wanted to do their own experiment. So they decided they would do push-ups. So they were replicating this 10 sets of pull-ups with 3-minute rests with or without cooling. And we did a crossover experiment. So all of the students did have the opportunity to condition with the cooling. So that group had incredible improvement in their performance, and it included several women. So there were 3 freshman women who were not athletes. By the end of that experiment, they were doing over 800 push-ups. They came into me one day and they said, "Dr. Heller, you cost us a lot of money." "Why?" "We had a formal dance this weekend. We all had to buy new sleeveless dresses."
Wow. So based upon this, I mean, I'm trying to figure next order. Fatigue and muscle temperature are a factor in terms of working to failure.
Right? Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, if you talk about mechanical tension, working to mechanical failure, we can effectively by, I guess, through heat, I mean, would the same be true on the other side, that if you artificially heated somebody up, they wouldn't perform it as well as they would at a cooler temperature?
Absolutely.
So like, hey, if I can do 10 reps here, if you were to put my hands in, let's say like hot mitts, I might be able to do the same thing 6 times, or if I cooled them, I might be able to do it 20 times.
Yeah. So the experiments we do along those lines are mostly aimed at developing methods for emergency workers, such as, you know, firefighters, Ebola workers, for an extreme. And what we do is we have them exercise in a hot room at 42 degrees centigrade. And frequently we dress them in personal protective equipment,
sure,
like you would wear in an infectious disease ward. And they increase their temperature very fast. And as they increase their temperature, their performance goes down, 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 down.
Huh. Well, I mean, you think about the ramifications. Let's say, you know, I was fortunate to play in the NFL for 10 years. You know, you think about, I played in hot weather games. I played in the hottest game in NFL history, 163 degrees on the field. And then I played in, you know, one of, I think, the top 10 coldest games, which obviously was like a negative 30s game. I can't necessarily feel that my performance was diminished on one side or the other, other than the fact that, you know, my hands were frozen and I couldn't punch. But, you know, it's a man, I almost, so with the studies on hypertrophy, were the hypertrophy, I mean, as long as you're working to failure, technically hypertrophy is a side effect of like mechanical tension and mechanical failure. So by actually heating the muscle, you could get there sooner. So in theory, you would need less to do the same amount. Does that make sense?
That's true. That's true.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hypertrophy
is not necessarily directly related to strength. So you can have growth of muscles without increase in the contractile fibers. So all hypertrophy is not the same, which is what essentially we discovered comparing the data for anabolic steroids with cooling. So both cause hypertrophy, but with the cooling is hypertrophy with increase in strength. For example, one of the ways we measure the increase in strength is to do a pyramid protocol, where the peak of the pyramid starts at your one rep max. And then you can see over time how that one rep max increases. And that's just pure strength.
What was the, like the time frame? Like you said, because I'm sure you ran like a double blind study. So you were doing these one RMs. One guy wasn't cooling his hands. The other one was cooling your hands over time. What did that pyramid look like over 8, 10, 12 weeks?
I could pull that up. I don't know if I have it in the top of my head, but it was something like I'd have to look it up. It was very significant comparing.
Was it 10%?
With the same individuals with and without. It was, you know, 10, 20%, I think. Oh, wow. I could look it up and let you know. It was some time ago.
And
the important thing to remember is these gains you keep. You have to do the cooling to get to the higher level, but that results in a true conditioning. You keep your gains as long as you don't become a couch potato.
Sure. Well, the steroids do a few interesting things. I mean, and this comes anecdotally, which actually came from Louis Simmons, who told me this many years ago, which is pretty fascinating that most of the steroid research is kind of intuitive, where, you know, these coaches have made observations. Louis Simmons from Westside Barbell has since passed away. Made an interesting observation once that the higher the amount of testosterone, the more efficient the nervous system. So the easier it is to recruit motor units. So he found that the guys that were on higher amounts of drugs could get less or get more out of less work. And he said, hey, as a non-drugged athlete, you might need 10 reps to drive adaptation. My drug guys might need 4 or 5. So they don't need as much volume because they get more out of less. So I'm wondering if like the cooling of the hands increases central nervous system efficiency and motor unit recovery and motor unit firing.
Well, what's true of all those claims is there's not a lot of good data I mean, there's a lot of intuitive explanation of results, but not necessarily. So I don't even know how you would measure changes in the efficiency of the nervous system. Then there were all sorts of variables like, your adrenaline. But definitely adrenergic tone goes up as a result of exercise, and you may not need an hour of exercise in order to get the same boost in adrenaline, noradrenaline that you're getting in the first 20 minutes. There's a lot of claims out there that you really have to look into them and see what they're based on.
Yeah, no.
I'm not saying they're bad or they're wrong.
No.
It's just, you got to be careful.
It's funny, as we're talking, I'm getting hit with like 4,000 questions in my mind, thinking about, more importantly, how this applies in terms of like not only strength, but conditioning. Like, for example, if we're doing a ton of like lactate work, where we're really trying to rebuild the plumbing and create better gas exchange, let's say intervals on, an air bike, like what would be like an optimal amount of cooling that an athlete would need to get the effect of like strength versus something like conditioning, like, versus, like, hey, I'm doing 1RMs. I need to cool my hands X amount of time. And is it every other set, like kind of volume and frequency? And is it an exposure? How does the environment of the room go in? If it's a hotter climate, is it more efficient? If it's a colder climate, like here in Texas, it's real cold part of the year. And then the rest of the year, it's like you left the oven on. So just thinking about, the different environments, different athletes, body fat, you're talking about like the hands. Is there an issue where like a thicker palm that might have more fat on it, higher difference in body fat, muscle mass, age, elasticity of the skin, all of these factors, collagen.
And for linemen, taping.
Yeah. Well, I used to wear receiver gloves, and then I would put pads on it. Mm-hmm. Then I would tape and cast my hands, so I couldn't take my gloves off.
Yeah. Yeah. So those are true variables. You mentioned lactate, and that's something we're studying right now. And what we've shown, which has never been shown before, is that the lactate threshold is temperature sensitive. So if you simply heat the body up before you measure the lactate threshold, it's much lower. Hmm. But that's, we're looking at that because of the myth, a couple myths. One is that lactate causes fatigue. No, it doesn't.
Yeah, we had a podcast. We had a podcast about this, and I asked the guy who was a researcher on lactate, how did we get this myth wrong? And he said about 250 years ago, they he's like, they were I think they killed a deer, and they were going through and doing dissection in this, and obviously it had elevated form of lactic acid, so they just called it that. And he's like, this is one of the worst myths we've ever had, because everybody thought the burning in your muscle was lactate, when really it's a fuel and the preferred fuel for the brain.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You got that right. But there's another myth that, at least I think it's a myth. I can't prove it yet, but the myth is that you need to have the muscle soreness after a workout in order to get the muscle hypertrophy.
That is 100% a myth, and that's been proven that there's no connection between muscle damage and, more importantly, delayed onset muscle soreness and hypertrophy.
Absolutely. You got it.
Yeah.
And the way we know that is that we get these incredible increases in performance, in workload, from one day to the next. So we've had professional athletes, including NFL football players, come in that one day they may double the number of reps they're doing in a particular activity. They always say, I can see the words coming out of their mouth, I'll be so sore tomorrow. And they never are, never. So we're doing a study right now on the causes and ways of mitigating delayed onset muscle soreness. So that's work that's ongoing right now.
Yeah. Wow. So let's dig in on like the nuts and the bolts, and more importantly, like the technology piece. I mean, I feel like if, you know, for people living at, or at, sorry, people listening to this at home, like understanding the technology, how it kind of evolved, and more importantly, how it's kind of used, so that then we can kind of go back and figure out like how we can use this in different environments, both not only in the weight room for strength, but conditioning, and then also for performance enhancing during the sport.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've already told you a lot of the story, the initial story of how we got into this line of investigation and the early experiments that led to the Eureka moment. Most of the work that has been going on since then has been documenting the effects with various types of activities and experiments, and also trying to extend it more into women. We haven't published that yet, but we get equivalent results in women. They don't start as high, but their rates of gain are similar. And the major work that we have in front of us now is constantly improving the technology, improving the device. The initial devices that we made were terrible. I called them coffee pots. And they were very expensive because they had like 200 parts. They had to be hand assembled because this was not a high number production facility line. So that was pretty much, even though they got good results, that was pretty much a failure. Yeah. So the company that started that shut it down. They shut down the work on the cooling and they went to medical applications. So we started a new company to improve the technology, and that's the CoolMet company. And that was started by the man who was our project manager at DARPA, you know, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Well, he had been at DARPA for a rotation, and he was the one who funded our initial work in order to speed up the conditioning of recruits before they could be deployed. And we blew that out of the water. There was nothing that compared to the results that we, so after he left DARPA, he did other things, and then he came back and he said, look, I'm really interested in making sure that the things that I had funded get successful. And he started this new company, which is, first of all, started out with designing a much easier device to use, that's CoolMet. And the reduction in price is because of the simplification of the technology. So it's much less expensive than it had been, even though it's still not mass production, which will bring the price down a lot. But the thing that we found out for athletics is that we don't need a component of that earlier device, and that was the vacuum I told you about, to pull blood into the arm. Working athletes already have maximum blood flow. And what we found is that by eliminating that vacuum component, you could so easily use two hands instead of one. Because when you had that vacuum component, you had to seal around the wrist. And that you can't do that without a hand, unless someone else does it. And then you can't get it off quickly. So the CoolMet, you can easily get in, get out, get in, get out, get in, get out, wipe your brow, drink some water. And the two hands are much more effective than one hand with vacuum. So that's sort of the story of the technology up until now. What we're working on now is to make it into a more wearable or continuously usable form. And that would be important for firefighters, for emergency workers of all kind. So that's a major agenda item on our research, in our research.
So we've used the CoolMet. It's just the palms. Yeah. So is there any benefit to cooling the entire hand?
No. So the skin of your hand is called glabrous skin. It's hairless. It doesn't have hair follicles. We think we are hairless, but we're not. We have hair follicles in all skin areas except the palms of the hands, the soles of the feet, and the upper part of the face above your beard line. including the forehead.
Okay? I don't know. I've seen some hairy guys with hair growing under their eyes. So,
yes, that's
is there a connection? Like, for example, could you cool the bottom of the feet?
Yes. Yes, for firefighters, that's what we're focused on.
So I was making like field, cool boots.
Yeah, for field workers, that would be ideal.
Okay. Oh, people that are working with their hands. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't want to cut you off, but hairless skin on the hands.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you think about our evolution, okay, we're mammals. And all mammals except us, well, most mammals, have fur. If you have fur, you can't lose heat over your skin surface very easily. So in mammals, they have evolved these special blood vessels in the non-hairy skin areas. The pads of the feet, the nose, the ears, the tongue. So what we're doing is we're just exploiting something that we inherited from our ancestors who really did have fur all over their bodies.
Wow.
But the skin is actually a good insulator. The skin is a very good insulator. And that's why the cool mitt cools the blood that's going back to the heart. So what you're doing then is cooling from the inside out rather than from the outside in.
Sure. Well, and the hands obviously being closer to the heart, it would be more beneficial to do the hands and the feet.
Right. And also the cardiac output is predominantly going to the working muscles. Oh. So you're not only cooling from inside out, but you're sending the cooling to where it's needed. I mean, you literally have the capacity to cook your own muscles.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, rhabdomyolysis.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Because a big skeletal muscle, a dynamic skeletal muscle, can increase its metabolism much, much more than it can increase its blood flow. And the blood flow is the only way the heat gets out of the muscle. So when you're using those large dynamic muscles, you are automatically raising the temperature of that tissue. Now, you may do a bunch of bench presses, and you may not see much of a change in your core body temperature. But if you measured the temperature of those muscles that are involved, that would be rising quickly. So it's really important to be able to pull that heat out of the working muscles, not necessarily out of your liver or your gut.
What would be, I'm sure you tested all temperatures for this. Was there an optimal temperature for the palms?
Yes. And you raised that issue very early on. Why not use a bucket of ice water?
Yeah.
It's too cold. So the ideal temperature for the palm for an athlete is around about 12 degrees centigrade. If you go lower than that, a large number of people will have a local vasodilation. In other words, if you just stick your hand in a bucket of ice water, you're going to vasoconstrict the blood flow into that hand, not necessarily constrict the blood flow going to other parts of your body.
So it's There's so cold that the blood vessels in the hands will constrict and it won't have the effect which we need is the cooling to the heart.
A local reflex.
Yeah.
So in other applications such as aged, aged people frequently suffer from hyperthermia. They're not as effective at dumping heat, but also people with certain diseases like multiple sclerosis, they are very temperature sensitive. As soon as the ambient temperature goes up a little bit or they get a little active, their symptoms get worse.
I was also thinking for type 1 diabetics. My son's a type 1. And we go, you know, and when he's training, like playing baseball and running around, all of a sudden his blood sugar spikes. And I have to like get him to cool down and relax. I'm wondering now as I'm thinking like, man, I should just pop his hands in there and cool him down. It should be able to bring him down really quickly.
Yes. Yeah. So I just wanted to mention that for the people with multiple sclerosis, you can't cool them down below about 21, 22 degrees, or they will vasoconstrict. So different conditions set different limits. So the CoolMIT now is designed for the average serious athlete. who will not vasoconstrict until you get down to about 10 degrees or lower.
So what's the present CoolMIDS temperature? Is that an industry secret?
About 12.
About 12 degrees Celsius?
Yeah. Celsius, yeah.
Yeah, so that's like 50.
I'm not good in thinking.
Yeah, I think that's 53 degrees something about Fahrenheit. It, yeah, if I, if my math is right. Yeah. Is there a like direct correlation between the amount of work and the cooling, or is it like a I'm just thinking like you know, if we have a 3 minute rest set, does it make sense to cool for 60 seconds, 3 minutes? Is there an optimal time?
Yeah, there is, but it's a sliding scale. So the rate of heat extraction is sort of an exponentially declining curve. So you get the biggest impact in the first minute, second minute less, third minute less, and fourth, fifth. So we picked 3 minutes for a very good reason. That's about as much as an athlete will want to sit around and not do anything.
Sure.
But we had one experiment that I think was very interesting. We, our football team has a drill called getting yards. They start at the goal line, and they then sprint for a minute. And then they wait 3 minutes, and then they do it again. And this is something they design, not us. So we went over to the field on various days, and for half of the team, we would have them from wherever they ended their sprint, they'd walk back to the sideline where we were and get cooled. But that was only maybe a minute or a minute and a half, because they had to get back to the goal line to start the next sprint. But what we found was that on cool days, we had no effect. But on hot days, we improved their performance to be the same as it was on cool days. So that was only, you know, limited cooling, just pulling a, heat out for about a minute or a minute and a half, two at the most, if they happen to stop their sprint right in front of us.
From I had a wise person, my buddy Rob Wolf, once tell me that if you analyze everything through an evolutionary model, you can kind of explain all of this stuff. And I keep going back to, you know, you talked about, you know, we're really the only hairless mammal. But evolutionary, I'm thinking like, what would it be about, you know, this, I mean, because every mammal has no hair on the bottom of their feet. Is that fair to say?
Well, no, that's not exactly true. But those animals that do have hair on the bottom of their feet, live in very cold environments. So for them, losing heat's not a problem. So we do a lot of work in our neurobiology area on Siberian hamsters. And they have hair on the bottom of their feet.
Yeah, because it's cold. But it, but is there an evolutionary reason that we would, I mean, obviously it's got to be a cooling factor where if you're in a hot environment, you don't want hair on your feet. But would having not hair on the feet in a cold environment be beneficial, similar to what we see in the cooling mitts, but then it would be constant, so then it wouldn't have the same effect.
Right, right.
So is it the ability to rapidly cool that drives the adaptation, or the ability to stay cool? Because I was thinking, like, what if you had gloves on that kept your hands cool all the time while you were lifting weights, or your feet were cooled all the time while you were training?
That's great. It's just that you don't always have that ability, that opportunity.
But I was thinking like kind of like similar like a race car where if you rev it high and then you're able to rapidly cool and bring it down, it's actually this cascading effect that continues to kind of drive because you're pushing the bounds of what you know is possible, cooling it and kind of almost like tempering the metal. You're heating it, pounding it, cooling it, and kind of doing this, which allows you to effectively, you know, temper and be more resilient.
Yeah. We have done some trials with race car drivers, and it has helped them. The only problem was the devices we had at that time were not very convenient to have in the cab of a race car and do it continuously. So that's an area where we could have an impact in the future.
So somebody would need to have two units to cool both hands at the same time, or would it be like 90 seconds in one and then pop it out and do 90 seconds on the other?
This would have to be an ergonomic study to see what the optimum is. You can't be doing switching things if you're, you know, concentrating on driving the car.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking in how I'm going to hack this in. I mean, you guys were, you know, sent me some units to demo, which is very nice. Thank you. I'm just thinking like, and we've been playing with them, but I purposely didn't go on and do any deep dive research on the units until we spoke, just because I wanted to be a little naturally curious and also figure out, you know, hey, how can we do this from the expert? Because as I went through and read the information, I didn't get what you're telling me from, and maybe it's hard to convey this, but I mean, it's pretty interesting that when you compare it to performance enhancing drugs, like this is something that could effectively extend those gains far beyond, you know, something like in, you know, exogenous performance enhancers.
Well, you're right. It is hard to get across all of that information in a 2-page instruction.
Yeah.
And most people would be bored by it. So I'm actually working, I'm trying to find time to work on a Scientific American paper now that will bring it, I think, more to the general public. And certainly podcasts like yours do a great service along those lines in giving an opportunity to bring the science down to a common language that everybody not only can understand, but can be interested in.
Sure. Well, I think everybody's searching for the ability to do more with less, right? Like, you know, I get questions all the time. You know, if I work out for an hour once a week, is that as good as working out 3 times a week for 20 minutes? That was a question I got recently. And I'm like, no, I would rather you train with more frequency, because the person that trains with the greatest amount of relative intensity over time is the person that makes the greatest performance gains. Yeah. If you only train for 1 hour once a week, but that's all you can train in your life, and you only give me 4 training sessions a month, that's better than zero. But I would much rather take 20 minutes of intensity 3 times a week than 60 minutes of prolonged intensity. So thinking about this and being like, okay, if it's a 3-minute rest and we can effectively hypercool the hands in such a way that every set you can train with a greater amount of relative intensity, if you look at the curve over time, you know, the performance on the other side should be dramatically better.
And then, of course, it's going to depend on whether you're interested in anaerobic gains or you're interested in endurance.
Oh, cool.
Both.
I mean, is there is there a way to use it for one versus the other? Are they both used in the same way?
Well, it'll be certainly a lot easier when we have a wearable to do the endurance. Now, the way we do the endurance is essentially have one of our devices literally suspended with a bungee cord over the treadmill, and you can just easily slip in it and slip out of it. But that's certainly not something that people would want to do in their homes. So we're working on a wearable system, and that's one of the reasons to be able to use it continuously. But we have gotten dramatic effects in many cases. Let me give you my own example.
Perfect. I love the anecdotal stuff.
Okay. I told you about the students that did their push-up study.
Yeah.
And that was a long time ago now. So they were joking with me and they said, okay, you can join us. You can be our age control. I was 60 then. And I said, sure, I'll be your age control. So on my 61st, I guess it was my 60th or 61st birthday, was the end of that experiment. And I did 1,000 push-ups.
Over what period of time?
That same routine with 3 minutes, so about a half an hour, 40 minutes.
So you were doing 100 sets of 100 push-ups.
I started for that last set, the last day, I think I must have been starting around 160.
Just continuous push-ups.
Yeah. So it takes, you know, about a minute, and then your 3-minute rest. So you're talking about for 10 sets, you're less than 40, 45 minutes.
Damn. We had one of the guys I trained, just periodically what I do is I check their, there was a study that talked about a direct correlation between the amount of push-ups that you can do cold and your chance of a heart attack. I think if you can, you know, if you can do less than 10 push-ups, you have a 50% chance of having a heart attack. And I think if it goes all the way up, so we just came in and just started doing, all right, one set of max rep push-ups. And I was right around 40 and ended up pushing it up every couple of days. We would just drop down. I was able to do 60, but I can't imagine the ability to do 100, cool for 3 minutes, and then continue to bang out those sets of 100.
Well, I can't say I routinely condition these days.
Well, no, 80. But now you got me excited because I'm like, I know how to hack my way back into this with the cool mitts.
I can still do 100 on my first set.
Damn. All right. That's beyond impressive.
I'm not pushing as much mass as you are.
No, but I mean, that's still good. I mean, you know, I just always thought that it was an interesting, it's kind of like everybody loves to shoot holes at the BMI, right? Like for the majority of people, the BMI is usually pretty accurate. The only time it doesn't is when you start talking about, you know, professional football players or people that have lifted weights for 20 years, or, you know, you kind of take out the segment of like athletes or people that are big gym goers that, you know, eat a high protein diet and take creatine and, you know, are trying to measure performance. You kind of like throw those people out. The BMI is pretty accurate. For most people, VO2 max and muscular endurance are great KPIs for health, and more importantly, markers for heart attack. And as a healthy man, I can't say healthy, but for somebody over the age of 30, if you can't do 10 push-ups, that's a huge problem. And you're probably at risk because there's other life factors driving towards this. You know, very few people are just going to, you know, lay down and bang out, you know, 60, 70, 80, 100 push-ups unless they'd done push-ups before. So I always thought it was a great indicator. So if I ever get commissioned to work with general population, for the majority of people I train, I was laughing the other day. I have three clients right now. We work with the guys at Development Group, Naval Special Warfare. They're SEAL Team 6. So we work with those guys. I have a 72-year-old billionaire who wants to lift weights and is on the road for this stuff. And then I train professional, you know, jujitsu guys that are 26 that are like rubber, that can train 18 times a week and beat them with a bat, and they're going to be fine the next morning. So it's pretty interesting across those, just asking them like as a check, oh, you were gone for a week, how many pushups do you have? And it's one of those things I just use as just a benchmark. We have other ways. We jump on the Echo bike and I'll have them do like, you know, 20 seconds max effort to see how much wattage they have. And I have a number for it. So I'm pretty excited now in terms of cooling the hands, because one of the things we've started testing is lactate, lactate levels before exercise, after exercise, and then how long it takes them to clear lactate.
Right. Yep. Yeah, that's a good thing to study. Let me give you one concession about your people of varying abilities. So the cool mitt is not going to do anything for the couch potato. Because what the cool mitt is doing is alleviating heat-induced impairment. So 10 push-ups is not going to end because the muscle temperature is too high. Okay, so you have to get up to some respectable level of performance before heat becomes the issue. There are all sorts of other things like the vascularization of the muscle, the cardiac output, and so forth and so on. So the cool mitt is only going to help clients who are at a decent level of conditioning and therefore are heat limited. And of course, if you're in Austin, that could be anyone in the summer.
I was very fortunate. I grew up in Southern California, grew up in a place called Palos Verdes, and then went to school at Berkeley. And so I lived in some really beautiful places till I was 22, 23 years old. And then I went to Philadelphia and since traveled and lived in the Midwest and realized that I was very lucky to grow up in probably one of the most beautiful places and go to college in, you know, the Bay Area being one of the most beautiful places and the most temperate, amazing places to ever live in. And now that I live in Austin, I long for the days that one day maybe be able to return to California. But it's a pretty interesting observation, not necessarily an observation, but just the research supports that, you know, something like this is a little bit more, it's not something that it's a beginner, you know, like, hey, I'm looking to get in shape, I'm going to use the cool mitts. It's something that once somebody's developed a certain level of capacity, they're training at a pretty high level, this is something that can really shoot past them. So it's not, you know, if somebody's going to say, hey, should I buy a barbell or the cool mitts? I'm going to be like, well, get a barbell. After you get real strong, now we can use this. So I kind of think about it more for more tip of the spear athletes or people that are looking to push performance past. Interesting. Was there any determining factors for like how well it worked? Like, was there age, body fat, ethnicity? You talked about men versus women, diet. I'm just wondering, like, what other factors would go to be able to support this?
Well, I can't say that we have done any extensive research in those variables, but we do have anecdotal cases. So, for example, we had no effect on our gymnasts.
Oh.
And because their hands are so calloused that the heat flow across the calloused skin was not optimal. I shouldn't say we had no effect, but it was certainly much less dramatic. So what we would have had to do for them is actually decrease the temperature of the setting. That wasn't easy to do with the technology. So the other hand, where we've had an effect on the gymnasts, or what they want is they want heating pads that they could stand on, because between their different rotations, it's actually cold in the gym.
Sure.
So the other group that we had no effect on, at least for what our initial goal was our crew team. We thought we could increase their speed of rowing. And of course, that's not something they train for. They train for pacing, because they all have to be paced at the same level. So we had no way of measuring the force of their pull. But if you think about it, you can't improve the force of the pull without increasing the rate of rowing, because your resistance stays the same. So we were able to show that we could have just improvements in their other activities in the gym, but not their rowing. And if you actually went over to the gym when they're doing their erging, they're doing it to music.
Yeah.
And the music is also pacing them. So part of their training is not necessarily to get faster, but to get to stay in sync with your teammates.
Sure. So then something like, we're talking about performancing, but like, you know, in something more classical, like bodybuilding, for example, where, you know, hypertrophy is the gain. And we talked earlier in the podcast about the difference between, I shy away from the term of functional versus non-functional hypertrophy, because I think, you know, muscle is always important.
Yeah.
I just think
right.
that there's certain muscle that has greater carryover. I mean, theoretically, a larger cross-sectional size of muscle should be able to generate more force until it can't. And we've seen people that are, you know, carry a lot of muscle but aren't very strong. I've seen people that don't carry as much muscle and are dramatically stronger because they train for strength over just hypertrophy. But yet I've also seen people carry a lot of hypertrophy that do nothing but singles, doubles, and triples. So I think it's, and anybody that says they know exactly how this thing works, I think is full of shit a little bit. But for something like hypertrophy, where you're training, let's say 8 to 10, reps, and you're working to failure, the ability to be able to cool the hands and do more repeated efforts and thus create a greater effect seems very prevalent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. When you think of hypertrophy, there are two basic mechanisms. One is increasing the number of cells, and that only comes through the replication of stem cells, which are in the periphery of the muscle fiber. But the other way you can increase hypertrophy is the increase the number of contractile elements. So if you increase the number of contractile elements, you're going to increase the strength more so than if you just increase the number of cells.
Yeah, those contract.
Not an expert in muscle.
Yeah, I'm not either. But I've read enough of it because there seems to be so many myths about hypertrophy. I mean, for a long time there was, muscle soreness. So, I got the muscle sore, it's going to grow in response. There was also this longstanding myth where, when you go in and train, you break the muscle down or you break the tissue down, and the muscle is in response to like scar tissue. Right. And we found that that's not the case. The other one was metabolic distress. So I'm going to create all this stress and there's all these metabolites and then that's going to drive. We found that one wasn't accurate either. So it really came down to that, you know, hypertrophy is the effect of, let's say, working to failure. And now I can't get the other rep. So then the muscle happens to allow you to blow past that. So if you think about the cooling of the hands, it actually fits right into it. Cause now I can work with a greater relative intensity over time. Cause if I can get 8 reps today and then do this and get 10 reps tomorrow, then I should be able to continue to progress. And one of the things that I've just anecdotally noticed over the 30 years that I've been doing this, that whatever you did yesterday, if you do it tomorrow, you're not going to make the same progress. I have to do a little bit more today than I did yesterday to continue to drive this curve.
Yeah, that's essentially what you're...
Yeah.
The other thing you have to recognize for different individuals, and that is they're already way past the most important decision they could make in order to know what type of conditioning will help them. And that's picking their parents. There's nothing you can do to change the distribution of your fast and slow twitch fibers. You can only make them a little bit more like the other through conditioning. But if both your parents were cross-country skiers, you're not going to be a champion weightlifter.
No, I mean, I found that there were 3 elements for athletic success: genetics, geography, and opportunity, right? Genetics, obviously, mm-hmm. your parents, but geography, like if you want to be a cross-country skier, you better be from Finland or Norway or, you know, Canada or someplace with snow. You're not going to be a cross-country skier in Miami. And then you need the opportunity to do this. And when they look at, let's say, like football or wrestling, and they kind of have these hotbeds where it's like, wrestling in Ohio or wrestling in these different places. It's because, you know, there's wrestling clubs. I mean, there's wrestling clubs all over Texas, but football is king in Texas. So you're going to get a lot of football players come from Texas just because this is what people do. So you got to have that genetics, geography. So it's my son just turned 8. And he plays on a little club team and for baseball, and these parents are so into it, and all their kids are going to play in the major leagues in this. And I kind of put up my hands and I was like, I was fortunate to play in the NFL. I just knew I grew up with 2 older brothers. We lifted weights. My brothers and I are all like, I'm 6'6", my other brother's 6'7", my other brother's 6'3", so we're always pretty tall, and we like to fight. So it ended up being pretty easy to go play football. So genetics, geography, and opportunity. But
yes.
It's really been fascinating for me in that, I come from a strength conditioning background. And then about a year and a half ago, I was approached to work with these Brazilian jiu-jitsu guys. And one of the guys is the top ultra in the world. And when they came in, 25 professional athlete, playing in the NFL, a 25 professional athlete, I'd been lifting weights since I was 14 years old and had trained with some of the world's best. And these guys come in and what they had done for strength conditioning wouldn't pass as like what we would do in elementary school. They had, gone to the gym and did some stuff. So it's been really fascinating to work with high-level athletes that don't have an exposure to this stuff. And everything that we do is like the greatest thing we've ever done. Like get them a little bit stronger and you see dramatic effects. So what we've ended up doing a ton of work on this year is, we brought in force plates because I want to measure their ability to reduce and apply force, start measuring lactate curves. And then this cool mitt's going to be the other component that I'm going to add into their training within the next 8 weeks to see if we can really do it. But also I want to use it in 2 environments. I want to use it in between sets, but I also want to use it in the jiu-jitsu. So in between, if they roll for 3 or 5 minutes, then, take a 3-minute rest, cool their hands, and then see if they're able to perform at a high level against a fresh opponent who did not do it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And one of the things that you learn from the people that are trying it is that you usually don't hear them say, I feel cooler, because we sense our temperature in our skin, not in the core of our body. But what they say is, I feel refreshed. I feel energized. I feel like I can do it again. So the expectation that by using the cool mitt, you're going to all of a sudden feel cooler, that's not an immediate benefit. But what you can point to is, if you have someone in that situation, is, did you notice you stopped sweating?
Did you guys ever, what are they called? Where you squeeze and they test torque in the hand.
Yeah, the hand ergometer.
Yeah. Did you do any of those tests?
We haven't done that.
Man, that would be such an easy one to test to be able to get somebody. Well, maybe not, because it would be too short to necessarily have the muscle heating.
Well,
so we used to use them. We used to use them in college. That was how my coach gauged recovery. So we would come in and we had a baseline, and then we would come in and we'd have to squeeze, and the number had to be, you know, give or take 5%. And if it was super off, then we knew that something wasn't right, because to squeeze, you need a certain level of central nervous system efficiency and recovery. So if the number was off dramatically.
That certainly may be, yeah. That may be a way of increasing that nerve muscle. In other words, the number of synapses you have, that can increase. So if you have the connection between the nerve and the muscle,
yeah,
you can have an effect on that through conditioning without necessarily changes in temperature. So the muscles that are contracting your hand, they're less likely to heat up because they're smaller muscles. They actually are closer to the periphery of the body, so they're not as well insulated. So I would not expect to see dramatic changes in the hand ergometer, but something we should do.
What about heart health? If it's cooling the heart, you know, I mean, obviously, there were some really cool Finland studies where they were talking about sauna, where, mm-hmm. you know, they have a sauna culture, and that people were, I think it was 60 to 70 minutes a week over 174 degrees or 170 degrees, whatever that works out into Fahrenheit. They saw almost no instances of heart attack, and they were able to kind of have the slide scale of, you know, 10 minutes in the sauna versus 70. They could directly tie heart health. I keep thinking on, you know, the ability to cool everything to the heart so you can train at a higher level. I mean, for, you know, people that might have had maybe heart attacks or maybe be dealing with some form of heart disease, you know, we had other people on the podcast talking about, you know, being able to rebuild capillary density and elasticity of the wall through aerobic exercise and creating aerobic base. How could mm-hmm. something like this cooling of the hands help these people?
It could have, of course, if they are, once again, are they heat limited or not?
Yeah.
Okay. But even if they aren't heat limited, there is one psychological impact, and that is you enjoy the exercise more. We did an experiment once on obese women, and the whole idea was if we could increase their endurance on the treadmill, it would become an important part of their weight loss program. So we had our recruits divided into two groups. They were using one of our heat exchange devices, the old one, which was too klutzy, but we rigged it up properly. And half of them were set to an effective temperature, and half of them were set to a cool temperature that wasn't effective. Okay? So what we found was the ones that had the cooling, the effect of cooling, they did increase their endurance on the treadmill, and they did see an improved loss, a rate of weight loss in their program. But the most interesting result was the absenteeism. The ones that were in the cooled group had 100% attendance, and the ones that were in the control group had all sorts of excuses why on different days they couldn't come in. And the bottom line was women and men too, to a certain extent, but especially when they don't like to sweat and they don't like to be in a gym where everybody's sweating.
Sure.
So if you actually can make the exercise more enjoyable, it may not be because you're limiting the heat imposed deficiency. But what you're doing is you're making them want to do it. They're more engaged. They're more committed.
So is it, I mean, are they, well, I was thinking for myself, I sweat pretty easy. I think it's because I drink a lot of water, but it's just because I'm a big dude. But is it something with
that's an important conditioning result to lower your sweat threshold.
Yeah.
That's a very good, marathon runners, they sweat at a much lower temperature than non-marathon runners.
So is that because you know, I mean, obviously their body, I mean, what are the conditions for sweating? I mean, is it, you know, core temperature, elevation? I always thought that we sweat to the sweat and it ends up cooling our, it was a mechanism to cool our body faster.
Yes, that's what it is. Except it's not very, if you sweat too much, it doesn't do you proportionally that much good, because every drop of sweat that falls off the body isn't doing any good. So there is a limit as to how much benefit you can get from sweating, and we don't carry that much excess water in our bodies.
Yeah.
So yes, sweating is an emergency response. It's very interesting. There's some bunch of old studies on Aborigines in the Kalahari Desert where they run down their prey, and it may take days to actually exhaust the prey. And what these bushmen carry with them are just a little gourd of water. And they don't use it for drinking. What they do is when they stop periodically, they put a little bit of water on their hands and they put it on their face and their hands. And that's the way of using a small amount of water to the most benefit.
Wow. Interesting. So Doc, what would you say if you were going to kind of wrap this thing up in terms of like takeaways, cooling the hands for 1 to 3 minutes, three optimally at a temperature of 12 degrees Celsius, around 53 degrees, can increase somebody's ability to do work dramatically. And was there,
it decreases the heat limitation. So there was a study done in the Air Force lab, I think, with our technology, and they concluded it didn't work. But if you looked at the data, their experimental group to begin with had no deficit. I mean, the controls and experimentals were the same. So they didn't get to the point where they had a decrease in their performance because of heat. So under those conditions, you're not going to have a benefit.
Sure. So you would see more benefit in, let's say, like a hotter environment. Like all of a sudden, if somebody was in a room that was 53 degrees and I was training in a gym that was 53 degrees, my body would not cool up as, or would not heat up as fast. Whereas if it was 100 degrees, the ability to cool the hands down to 53, we're going to see a huge performance uptick.
Right. Yeah. And let me tell you one thing you asked about the heart. One of the things to remember is that when you're exercising and your core temperature is rising, so is your heart rate. This is called cardiac drift. So you start exercising, your heart rate goes up to the right level for that level of exercise. But then you keep exercising, your core temperature is rising, and the heart rate is paralleling that. And the point at which you reach your age-adjusted maximum heart rate is about the same as which you reach your voluntary hyperthermia level. In other words, the point where you say, oh, gotta stop. So those two things are very much in parallel. So if you do decrease your rate of rise of core temperature, you're going to increase the capacity of strengthening your heart.
Yeah, we did some testing on, because the age-related heart rate, the 220 minus your age, I think fits for maybe general population. But when you start talking about athletes, like I'm 47, right, and I was able to get my heart rate up to 191. And
big harder.
Yeah, well, I got a big heart. So I mean, the ability to be able to do it, but we push regularly close to that. You know, not like, you know, but then we had the guy on who is USA triathletes coach. And, you know, these kids are, you know, USA triathletes, so they're in the sprint tries, 18 to 22, 23 years old. They were working at 95, 97% of their max heart rate for 30 to 40 minutes straight, which seems insane to me. But they were able to function and work and be able to work at that for such a high level. So it's pretty interesting that, you know, for most people, it's unimaginable just because they never do it. So it feels like whatever you go to, the body's very adaptive at whatever you, you know, whatever, I mean, whatever environment you're going to put it into, you're either going to sink or swim. And if you're young enough and you have enough opportunity to be able to train into it, you can do these things.
So those individuals that were exercising at the maximum heart rate, did they have the ability to adjust their level of output?
Yeah, I think that they were, I think within the lactate curves. Now, he didn't get into this, but I do know that they were charting lactate curves, and they found that there was a certain wattage that they were able to kind of like, you know, let's say they were riding at 1,000 watts. They found that they cleared lactate at like 700, whereas instead of resting, they were able to just kind of decrease the intensity to clear lactate and then go back up. So I don't know how their intensity was related to heart rate, but he made a point that during these races, these guys are able to function near max heart rate for extended periods of time. And be able to be high performers. So
to do that, they have to not continually push their output level.
Yeah. They probably just stay very consistent in what they are. They can function at that level. And then I don't know. I mean, it was one of those things that as the guy was making the claims, I wanted to see, like, I'd like to see with my own eyes. Like, I'd like to see them in the training room. I'd love to see the numbers and, like, you know, see the look on their face to be able to work at that level for 40 minutes straight seemed pretty fantastic.
One of the advantages is that you have is you don't have to abide by the rules of an institutional review board.
Yeah, I'm sure everything you have an ethics review.
It's within constraints, right?
Yeah, I guess you have to do ethics. And, you know, when you guys do studies, you're pulling kids off the street. So just because a lot of the studies are extremely skewed, if you're using professional athletes or people that are highly trained, I mean, everybody wants, you know, unadapted, untrained individuals you pulled off the street to see, you know, how it has that effect.
I really enjoy talking with you.
Yeah, no, it feels like for trained individuals, this is an incredible thing. Well, I'm excited to dive into it and put it to use. And hopefully in, next couple months, I'll be able to report back and see if I can match your findings.
Fantastic. Yeah, I always say when coaches come in and they wonder about it, I say, try it on yourself first. Just establish your numbers for any activity. What is your max? What is your performance level? Okay. Then try it with the cooling. And you can see on yourself.
So I got a protocol that I can put in place every other set or every, like if I got five sets, is it better to do it after the first set, the third set? Like how would you break it up? Second set, how would you do that?
I don't know.
Okay.
Perfect. We just standardized on one particular protocol because every time you change a dimension of the protocol, then you start all over again.
Sure. All right. Well, I'll create some protocols and we'll start testing them. Dr. Heller, thank you so much for taking the time.
Okay. Thanks.
Yes, sir. Bye-bye. Thank you. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales we've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's ko-fi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.